Handpicked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
From WJFF in Jacksonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Manor Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported, monthly newspaper published by Livingston Manor Free Library. And today, we'll be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, back to school. Manor Inc. spoke to Livingston Manor Superintendent John Evans and Elementary Principal Christopher Hubert about the 2021-2022 school year and reopening plans. Will Netflix film a TV series in Livingston Manor? Two local producers hope so. We spoke to them about their pitch for their show called The Manor. Plus, my review of the martial arts film Paper Tigers and my letter from the editor. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The search for missing people in the northeastern U.S. is ongoing after the remnants of Hurricane Ida tore through the region. At least 49 people are now confirmed dead. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports that many people in New York are trying to put their lives back together.
Friends of Diana Silverman of Flushing, Queens, helped her find a new car after she lost the one she was driving during the floods in New York City. Silverman's old car floated away after she climbed out of the driver's side window to escape.
I don't think that I'll ever want to drive again in the rain, to be completely honest.
Silverman says she was able to shelter in a nearby home with other stranded people during the storm.
It was kind of nice, in a way, to see that people still just kind of come together when something like that happens.
New York City officials say they may put in place travel bans before the next storm, now that climate change is creating the conditions to make flash flooding more common and intense. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News, New York.
The company that provides power to New Orleans says it expects to have the lights back on for most customers in the city by Wednesday. And New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell is encouraging evacuated residents to return home and help relief efforts by taking in neighbors and family who remain without electricity. Hospitals in West Virginia, among those reporting record numbers of admissions as the pandemic surges, fueled by the highly contagious Delta variant. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports hospitalizations and the use of intensive care units are not expected to peak in the state until later this month.
Those advising Governor Jim Justice say the current surge has put immense stress on hospital staff, and things are likely to get worse in the coming weeks. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation projects that West Virginia will need more than 1,500 hospital beds and 500 ICU beds for COVID patients by late September, more than double what was required during previous periods of peak demand. For NPR News, I'm Dave Mistich.
A controversial voting bill passed by the Texas legislature now facing multiple legal challenges before it's even been signed by Governor Greg Abbott. Texas Public Radio's Joy Palacios reports the bill's opponents say it would make Texas the hardest state to vote in the country.
Senate Bill 1 further restricts voting by mail and bans drive-through and 24-hour polling places. One federal lawsuit in a San Antonio court says it limits voter assistance and allows voter intimidation by partisan poll watchers. Nina Perales is vice president of litigation for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She says SB 1 would reduce voter participation and discriminate on the basis of race.
The current legislative leadership has decided that they want to make voting harder in the wake of more people voting.
This bill is almost identical to one that led Texas House Democrats to leave the state and stop it from being passed earlier this summer. A second similar lawsuit was filed in Austin. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
And you're listening to NPR News. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is praising police for stopping Friday's stabbing attack in a supermarket in Auckland that left seven people injured, three of them critically.
To the New Zealand police, you were tireless, and I am told at times you had up to 30 people involved in monitoring this person. I want to acknowledge the work that you did leading up to this event and the work you do generally to keep us all safe.
Police shot dead the attacker, who has been identified as a Sri Lankan native who spent 3 years in a New Zealand prison before his release in July. Ardern says he was inspired by Islamic State and was being constantly monitored by police, and she's promising to tighten New Zealand's counterterrorism laws. Nicaraguan government this week took legal action against a number of detained former presidential candidates with only 2 months to go before presidential elections. They'll stand trial on charges ranging from treason to money laundering, as Maria Martin reports.
Nicaraguan prosecutors announced that one-time presidential aspirant Cristiana Chamorro will stand trial for money laundering. They say her Violeta Barrios Foundation, which received outside funding for journalistic freedom projects, acted to overthrow the government of Daniel Ortega. On Friday, prosecutors announced three other former presidential candidates who will also stand trial. All of them say the charges are politically motivated. The Nicaraguan Human Rights Commission says the hearings took place inside a Managua prison with no members of the public or the prisoners' families allowed. Analysts say the trials clear the way for Daniel Ortega to run for a fourth term in November without serious opposition. For NPR News, I'm Maria Martin.
And this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at kauffman.org.
This is Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Mannering. Livingston Manor Central School will resume classes on Tuesday with a full 5-day-a-week in-person schedule. Regardless of vaccination status, all students and faculty will have to wear masks inside, but they won't be required outside. Everyone is still to be at a social distance of 3 or 6 feet where appropriate. Routine cleaning, such as hand washing, sanitizing, and disinfecting surfaces will also be in effect. These are the basic guidelines that will be followed as school reopens. But there's a lot more in-depth information to cover. Mannering spoke to Livingston Manor Superintendent John Evans and Elementary Principal Christopher Hubert about the 2021-2022 school year and their plans.
To start off, what have been the main struggles with reopening the school?
Lack of timely information from the State Department of Health, from the governor's office, and from the State Education Department. The schools have been told since June that updated information would be forthcoming. Then towards the end of July. So everybody kind of like held off doing a lot with reopening plans because we were waiting for, you know, updated information. And then towards the end of July, the Department of Health and the CDC sent out some updated guidance. And the State Department of Health, let me back up. When the executive orders from the governor expired last June, everything that was tied to those executive orders no longer carried the weight of law. They were just like the Department of Health and the CDC, they were recommendations. Governor Cuomo's executive orders tied those documents to his executive orders and made it that, you know, schools were legally obligated to do everything that's in those documents. When his executive orders expired back in June, all of those legal requirements went away and everything kind of shifted back to where their recommendations, and you can kind of use, pick and choose which recommendations are most appropriate for your setting. What schools had been waiting for was something from an authoritative agency that kind of outlined what it is we had to do, what we were required to do to start school. And to date, that still has not arrived. So the State Education Department put some stuff out that reiterates their recommendation to follow the CDC guidance. Our local health department has issued some information that aligns with the CDC guidance. Because what happened last year is the CDC guidance would come out and then Governor Cuomo and the New York State Department of Health would issue things that didn't always align with the CDC guidance. So, you know, it was, and we were forced to follow the state requirement over the CDC stuff. So there were numerous times where the CDC guidance and the state guidance didn't align. So this year we're told plan on the CDC guidance. The state isn't going to give you anything. In the last 2 weeks, with the change in leadership that's about to take place, Governor Cuomo has resigned. The soon to be lieutenant, the current lieutenant governor that's going to take over as governor has issued a couple statements in the last week or so indicating that once she takes office, she's going to be working with the State Department of Health to issue some mask mandates and possibly some other things around vaccine requirements and things like that that currently don't exist in any of the other plans. So lack of information has been the biggest challenge for us this year and in throughout this whole entire pandemic. And it doesn't look like that's changing anytime soon.
So given how uncertain this current situation we have going on with the virus is, are there any certainties that we do have with reopening the school?
So one thing that has shifted, and that is, all of the data that they've tracked throughout this, that it shows that the transmission in schools has been extremely low, not non-existent, but very, very low. So the health and safety protocols that schools have been using, the masking, the social distancing, the cleaning and disinfecting, hand washing, hygiene, all of those things are the leading defense in keeping kids safe in schools and keeping schools open. All of the traumatic experience that kids have, that they've seen in kids who have not been in school, they feel kind of far outweigh, everything else, and that there's a large commitment to having schools open in person and kids back in school 5 days a week. And that is currently what everybody in Sullivan County is planning for, Livingston Manor included, being open 5 days a week in person, using the CDC recommendations that, indoor masking for all, the social distancing of 3 and 6 feet. Right now, every indication, we are planning for a full reopening, being open in person 5 days a week throughout the year. We're using the CDC recommendations, which our local Department of Health has issued, guidance to us that mirror the CDC recommendations. So indoor masking required for all staff and students, regardless of vaccination status, social distancing of 3 and 6 feet, routine hand washing, sanitizing, our amped up cleaning protocols that we've used, since this, started with stuff being wiped down and bathrooms being cleaned kind of throughout the day, cleaning, disinfecting, all of those things. Outdoor masks aren't required. That's in line with the CDC stuff. Right now, sports are online to start. All the current fall sports that we play are outdoor sports. So with outdoor sports, masks are not required to be worn on the playing field. But when kids are in groups or on the sideline and things like that, we'd have to put masks on. Coaches, if you're going to be in close contact, they recommend that masks, come into play. Spectators, if they can't social distance, mask would be required. But pretty much the outside sports, it seems to be masks aren't required. But the leagues and the sections are to send out some updated guidance before the start of fall sports. Busing, the CDC recommendations mirror the public transportation recommendations for buses, where There are not capacity restrictions. It's just that everybody needs to wear a mask. So that was some of the biggest hurdles to being open 5 days a week last year had to do with busing and lunch. So when we weren't able to put, you know, two kids in a seat on a bus and it was only one kid per seat, that created a huge challenge with getting everybody to school. And in lunch, not being able to put, you know, eight kids at an eight person table made it very, very challenging. Under the new guidelines, under the new recommendations, we can, if it's a 40 passenger bus, we can put 40 kids on the bus. Everyone just has to wear masks. In the cafeteria, now what they recommend is that you use assigned seats and have, you know, use kind of cohorting. So if there's a group of kids, they're going to eat together the same time, same place every day. Use outdoor eating spaces if possible. We have the spot outside of the cafeteria, which when it's nice out, a lot of kids, you know, go outside, and utilizing in the classroom. Again, back to the fact that there was a very, very low transmission rate in school. I think the numbers that the county had put out, and I would reach out to the county for the exact numbers, but it was something like 4,000 or 5,000 people were placed in quarantine over the course of the last school year that were directly related to schools. And of that number, I believe it was 30 or something people ended up testing positive. So and in a number of those cases, the exposure did not occur in school. It was an outside event that, you know, kind of led to. So the new recommendations allow us to put, you know, use our regular capacity in the cafeteria. But in the event that, you know, somebody tests positive, we need to know where everybody was sitting, because the individuals immediately around that person will most likely be placed in quarantine. If someone is fully vaccinated, they're really, all of our quarantine stuff is done in conjunction with the Department of Health. So they're, you know, whatever they tell us who needs to quarantine, and when we describe the situation and show, you know, talk about who sat where and for how long, all that kind of stuff, they're the ones that kind of, you know, tell us who we need to identify as being in quarantine. But the protocols that they're using in the new CDC and in the local Sullivan County Health Department recommendations, it indicates that if someone is fully vaccinated and they were exposed, they don't have to quarantine, but they recommend that they monitor for symptoms and in 3 to 5 days get COVID tested. Or if at any time they become sick, to, you know, quarantine and get tested. If they're unvaccinated, so kids under 12 that aren't eligible, and anybody that, you know, has not been vaccinated, you know, at this point, if they're, what they're saying is that if masks are worn correctly and consistently, that it's not considered an exposure. So if we're all sitting at the same table in a classroom and we have masks on and, you know, OC tests positive and we had our masks on and we were, you know, socially distanced, which is either 3 feet or 6 feet, or that according to the new CDC guidance, we would not have to quarantine because he had a mask on and we had masks on and they were worn correctly. If the masks were off, you know, so if it's a lunch situation, then the people directly next to them would most likely be placed in quarantine. Where last year, everything was, they didn't know what was going on and they didn't know how this stuff spread. So last year we had lots and lots of people placed in quarantine because if a kid in a classroom tested positive, everyone in that classroom was placed in quarantine. So even whether they were right next to them or not. And it wasn't consistent throughout the year. Sometimes it was the whole class went in. Sometimes It was just the kids immediately next to him. So kind of the guidance is right now is we will work with the Department of Health, describe the situation, and, you know, go with what their recommendations are. But what the guidance says is if masks are on and they're worn consistently and correctly, then people are not considered exposed and most likely will not need to quarantine unless it's in a cafeteria situation or, you know, some other situation where they didn't have masks on.
Are there going to be any mandatory vaccinations for eligible faculty and students?
Mandatory? No. Not unless it's ordered by the state. I don't believe, you know, any local schools are looking at mandating a vaccine. There's a lot of legal reasons behind it as an employer and dealing with, you know, collective bargaining units and things like that. I don't have the legal authority to mandate something to employees. The state, if it comes from the state side, I think that's a different story. But yeah, right now we're encouraging, you know, those that want to get vaccinated, will work with the county. You know, we've offered vaccination clinics at the school. You know, we fully intend to, you know, work with the county health department to set those up if they want to do more of them. But right now the vaccination is so readily available. You know, any of the pharmacies, Walmart, you know, all over the place, you know, all of the doctor's offices, you know, people that want to get it have access to it. You know, so we encourage them, but at this point as a school district, we can't force them or mandate it.
How does this year's situation, differ compared to last year's?
Well, right now there aren't a whole lot of executive orders that dictate what we have to do. So there's a lot more local control, and the fact that remote instruction is not a requirement. Remote instruction was a huge hurdle to being open. It to having people do multiple things at once. You know, so I think the biggest difference between last year and this year for at least all of the schools in Sullivan County is, and mostly across our region, you know, there is not a remote option required by state ed or the governor's office. So it's in person 5 days a week, you know, and there's a big push to get kids back in school, you know, every day.
Is there going to be any possibility at all of remote learning?
Remote instruction would be handled the same way any kind of special accommodation would be. And that would be through the CSC 504 process. So if, you know, there's anybody that's, you know, has a documented condition that would necessitate an alternate education plan, then, you know, they would reach out to the school district and contact, you know, Ms. Marrero to look at that process, to convene the Committee on Special Education and 504 committee to determine if whatever documented issue exists qualifies for some type of alternate remote instruction. So, and at this point, we don't have anyone with that accommodation.
What does, like, say, a best case scenario for reopening the school this year look like?
Oh, a best case scenario. That the guidance that we have now, with the exception of maybe a mask mandate indoors, doesn't change, and that what we've planned for, which is opening on September 7th, 5 days a week in person, running school as normal, with all of the activities and events and capacity limits and spectators and visitors, all of those things as normal, using the health and safety recommendations that are currently out there. So the masks indoors, the hand washing, the cleaning and sanitizing, the social distancing, using all of those protocols to be open like we were last year, without changes forced upon us days before school starts, because that creates chaos. You know, right now, I think I mentioned earlier on buses, you know, we, with the ability to use buses at capacity with wearing masks, that also brings back the ability for, you know, last year you could only be picked up and dropped off at the same location. We weren't allowed, we didn't have the ability, because space was an issue and capacity was an issue, we weren't able to handle those situations where, you know, we have working parents and you're picked up at your house in the morning, but in the afternoon you go to a babysitter and the bus can drop you off there. This year we're able to do that again. So the massive parent pickup and drop off that we had going on last year, hopefully will be reduced. I'm sure we'll still have some parents that still, you know, drive their kids to school and pick them up. But the line of people waiting because they couldn't, you know, their kid couldn't go to their grandparents' house or to, a babysitter, you know, we're back to being able to do that again. I just talked with Rolling V, this morning, and our plan is, you know, the same way we always have done in the past, if, you know, there's a request for a different, you know, drop-off location in the afternoon, that, you know, we're planning to be able to handle that like we did in the past. So best case scenario is school being as normal as possible, with the exception of having to wear masks, which I think at this point we're all kind of used to it. And it's just, you know, it's another piece of clothing we throw on in the morning when we go to school.
Feeding off of that, what would be a worst case scenario?
A worst case scenario is that if schools are forced to provide some type of remote option at this point, because there's monumental staffing implications and scheduling implications and challenges associated with that, along with connectivity issues with, a number of kids. We have the portable hotspots that we sent home. But, you know, as you guys know, living in this area, not everybody has cell service. Not everybody has a high-speed internet option where they live. So with those households, there's really nothing we can do to get them connectivity if there isn't high speed near them and they don't have cell service. So that was a significant challenge for us last year. We had a number of, and remote is hard. You know, staying home and attendance was really, really bad. With a significant number of students that were remote all the time last year. And when we had to go fully remote the couple of times, when we had a lot of people placed in quarantine, even those that had connectivity, a lot of them chose not to connect. You know, their parents would leave for work and they were hoping that their kids were online doing what they were supposed to do, but that was not always the case. You know, a lot of kids would log in and their camera wouldn't be on, and, you know, the teacher would call on them and they weren't answering because they weren't there. So logging in and not participating is pointless.
That, and there's some issues. There was also some times when parents did not know the technology. So kids would submit assignments and without anything attached. And it looks like something was submitted, but, you know, nothing was really submitted. So it was for students to get around it without the parents knowing or having any input in regards to seeing what they were doing in during their, with their homework or any kind of academics.
Right. That's a great point that Mr. Hubert makes. Remote instruction for 7th through 12th grade kids is very different than remote instruction for pre-K to 6th grade kids. The younger the kids, the less likely they are able to do these things on their own. So it requires an adult being there with them to do this. And if it's working parents, the kids are with a babysitter. And it's an unrealistic expectation, you know, for a babysitter that might have two or three kids that they're watching there, all in different grades, all in different classes, all have different teachers, you know, a babysitter to be responsible to, you know, be there to do remote instruction with three different kids all at the same time doing three different things. You know, we don't have teachers doing that, let alone people that aren't educators trying to do that. So remote instruction at the lower grades is extremely, extremely challenging. And while we did our very best to make it work, it was definitely not an ideal situation. And any shift to having to go back to remote is what I would say a worst case scenario. Having to utilize remote instruction is a worst case scenario. We're prepared to do it, and we'll do, you know, we're much, much better at it than we were March of 2020. You know, we have a lot more technology, a lot more devices. Staff, you know, teachers and staff are way more prepared, you know, technology wise. You know, we have cameras, we have Zoom, we have Google Meets, you know, we have, you know, everybody's got all their stuff in Google Classroom, you know, so the ability to do it is there where it wasn't in the beginning. You know, it's just not the most effective means of providing education.
Well, I think those are all the questions I had. Is there anything else that you want to say?
In, you know, talking with other kids, kind of what is the hope from the student side that you guys think that, you know, you guys are hoping this year looks like? For you, what's the ideal school year look like?
At least for me, the ideal school year, like something realistic, is being able to, like, go back in person, see all my friends with masks on and everything, of course, being as safe as possible, being able to do all that stuff, as well as being able to do all the other things about school, like after school activity type things, fundraisers, trips, and like sports and stuff like that. Like even like the inside sports, like basketball, things like that. That's what I would say it'd be a good school year, especially since it's going to be my senior year. So
getting your senior year as normal as possible.
Yeah.
You know, is our goal. I mean, the first year, that senior class of 2020, you know, their March through June sucked. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
Yeah.
The seniors last year, while it was not ideal, you know, did get, you know, they were able to have sports. They were in the spring. They were, it was different, you know, but it occurred. We were able to do some trips. It wasn't ideal, but at least, you know, there was something where the class before them got nothing. And I am hopefully optimistic based on kind of, you know, what we have to work within right now that, you know, your senior year is much more normal than the last two classes experienced. Mm-hmm. You know, and hopefully by the end of the year, normal, you know, where we don't have to wear masks and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So,
Yeah.
That's my hope too.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Upstream Wine and Spirits in Livingston Manor, specializing in sustainable, organic, and biodynamic wine and spirits curated from around the world, offering curbside pickup and local case delivery. UpstreamWine.com. From the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York, RiverReporter.com. And from listener donations at WJFFradio.org.
It was this pervasive and very real threat of persistent mistreatment that led her to defy her supervisor altogether. Pauline lost all of her food stamps and her Medicaid. As she said with disgust, even though I wasn't making that much money, I wasn't being treated like I'm a common piece of trash. Because I'm not. I'm not.
Erin Hatton, author of Coerced, Saturday at noon on the Janice Adams Show.
This is Radio Catskill.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, Teen Edition. I'm Mosley Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. In July of this summer, a spec trailer, a type of trailer film for the purpose of being pitched to a network, for its new series was filmed in Sullivan County. It's set to be pitched to Netflix and other networks later this month. And what's so important about this? Well, this series goes by the title The Manor, and if it's picked up by Netflix, it will be filmed in and around the little hamlet of Livingston Manor. I spoke with series creators Nico Martinez and Luke Nieves.
What's the title of the series and what's it going to be about?
So the title is called The Manor. We're pitching it as it's more like Riverdale meets M. Night Shyamalan's Signs. It's about a UFO activity in the small hamlet of Livingston Manor and how it affects a group of high schoolers, poor, you know, friends and their families, and how it starts to challenge their psyches, you know, and testing their friendships.
How did the idea for the series come to be about?
Well, we sort of wanted to pull from like real experiences that people have had. So after a lot of research and sort of finding out like what people have actually experienced in real life with these UFO encounters.
Especially in the area.
In the area of the Catskills. That sort of inspired the work and then sort of just grew into what it is now.
Cool. So why did you want to film it here in the Manor?
So, first we have a house, right up there. So we just, I guess growing up there, we always wanted to do a project in the Catskills. And then after, you know, some experiences and then finding out how many like UFO encounters and like experiences people in the Catskills, especially in Roscoe, have had, we thought it was sort of like the perfect place.
Yeah, we have a home in Livingston Manor. Luke was, after September 11th, we live in the city, obviously, but after September 11th, when Luke was a year old, we had just bought the home and we were part of an exodus of families that left New York City and moved to our fixer upper in the mountains. And we lived up there for 5 years and I taught at Tri-Valley. We just, you know, it's our home. And then my husband was offered a job at Columbia University and we made the decision to move back to the city, but we kept our, you know, we've always kept our house and we go up every summer whenever we can, we're up there, you know? So that's why the manor. For us, Livingston Manor and that area is a character in the show. Almost like Sex and the City, New York City was very much featured in Sex and the City. I mean, you're too young and I'm dating myself here, but that was a show that put the city just, you know, in a position where it's just as important as the characters. The same thing with the manor. We were blessed that one of the guys on the crew was a licensed drone operator. And oh my gosh, what he took of the mountains and the area. And it just, that's what we want. The area, the mountains are just as important, if not the star of the show. Because it's magical. It's magical. You know, we can't wait. My husband's 64. And we are just counting down the days for him to retire so we could just move up there full time, you know, and start our retirement years together up there.
What was it like getting permission to film like outside of the school?
How was all you?
Well, you too. It's a combination, you know. I mean, do you want to tell them about how you got like Liberty Diner and...
Well, no, he's talking about outside the school, like the insurance and stuff.
What, like Liberty Diner stuff outside school? Yeah, so it for the school itself was, it was challenging. I mean, you know, we had to get a certificate of insurance, and which wasn't that daunting, but it was, thank God, because I have a relationship with Tri-Valley. That was a lot easier to pull through.
Yeah, we used Tri-Valley for the interiors, and then mm-hmm. we did all the exterior shots at Manor.
At Manor. I know we just found out that HBO is shooting a series in Monticello, which is really encouraging for us, because that means that the networks are open to bringing business, you know, to the area. You know, crossing fingers. We're both fighting, and are very, very adamant about it being the manor where business would go and shooting, because it would bring an incredible amount of opportunity to people. Because you're not just talking about the actors, you know, you're talking about set building, carpentry work, electricians being put to work. So I just think it would be really, sorry. It would be awesome if we could, you know, get it to be shot up there.
Speaking of networks, as this is a pilot, do you have any specific networks in mind that you're going to pitch to? Like, is it supposed to be like for a streaming service or like for like live TV, like ABC, NBC or something like that?
Yeah, so we're aiming for Netflix. That's number one, but we're going to be pitching all sorts of places. So I guess we'll see what's in the cards.
If it does get picked up, how long is the series planned for? Like, is it like going to be like an 8-episode thing, multiple seasons?
Nine episodes.
Maybe 2-3 seasons.
We're hoping for 3 or 4, you know, seasons, depending on the arc of the show. And once we get a writer's room
it's going to change
it. How it, you know, there's so many different directions that the show could take.
Yeah, right now we're just focused on season one, but, you know, it could go so many places. So we're pretty open to that.
You have a set time that you want to release, like, the first season by?
That's all relative on just pitching and what, you know, the network wants to do. And I mean, ideally 2022 or 2023.
Well, because we've got already the first season that we're finishing.
Written.
So written. And we've got our leads pretty much casted. And we've got this trailer. So, you know, God willing, it could go pretty fast in terms of, let's say the network says, yeah, this is good. Let's move forward with this. You know, we could be looking at going right into pre-production with a shoot starting in late spring, you know, summer.
So what kind of a budget are you working with, at least for like the pilot? Because I know when, if it gets picked up, it's going to be different. But what kind of budget were you working with, at least for filming the pilot and hiring actors?
So we weren't actually filming a pilot. We were filming a spec trailer, and we had a pretty small budget, but we got everything.
Yeah, you know, we spent $7,000 on our trailer.
Yeah, we were lucky because the crew we had already had like the camera body. So it was just a lot of camera rentals for the lenses, but we ended up saving a lot of money because of that.
Yeah.
So what's the pitching process like? Like, what do you need to go through in order to, like, at least like even like with contacting, what do you have to make sure you have in order to have a good pitch?
An agent, which he has, because he's a working actor just starting his career, and a manager. So, you know, there's so many networks and producers that do not accept unsolicited material. So we're really blessed that we have the right people ready now once the trailer is done to now kick it forward to the pitch meetings and get us in the room with people.
If, let's say, this gets picked up and it does well, or even if not, do you have plans for other series to do?
Yeah,
definitely. That's the idea.
Yeah, I'm a writer, so he's you know, and I already have another project that I'm sitting on that I'd like to push forward. It's very different than UFOs. It's called The Islanders. It's the Latina immigrant experience on Long Island. I was taken out of my home at a young age, and I was taken in by the mayor of Rockville Center on Long Island. So I was sort of exposed to the wealthy. And so, you know, what that world is like. And so the Islanders sort of shows the underbelly of the wealth, but through a Latina's eyes.
I think that might be all the questions I have. Do you guys have anything else you'd like to say?
Just cross your fingers for us.
The Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop presents Clue at the Rivoli Theater, South Fallsburg, opening September 10th and running through September 19th. Clue is based on the classic movie and board game. Six hilarious guests and an out-of-control butler go through a pile of weapons and endless rooms to find out who killed the host of a dinner party. That's Clue, September 10th through 19th, paid for by the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop and the Rivoli Theater, award-winning theater since 1950.
Donna Fellenberg here, and on Catskill Character this week, I'll be playing a show I did in 2020 with my guest, the painter Bronwyn Curtis. One of her latest paintings, Chattagee Creek Pond, recently became her first work to be sold at a gallery. Please join Hancock's own Bronwyn Curtis and me this Saturday at 11:30 on WJFF.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor, Inc. In the current issue of Manor, Inc., I have two film reviews. One is an awesome action flick, and the other is a painful teen movie. I'll spare you the dumpster fire that is The Kissing Booth 3, and instead share my review of the movie that was released in May of this year, The Paper Tigers. It feels good to be back to reviewing another martial arts film. Now that I have two review sections, I can review lovely action flicks and painful teen movies. I was planning on reviewing a classic Jackie Chan film, but I came across this movie that was released in May of this year, so I thought it'd be best to save the older film for another time. Well, let's not waste any more time, and fly right into the review of The Paper Tigers. The Paper Tigers is an action comedy movie about three kung fu practitioners well out of their prime trying to avenge the death of their sifu, which means master. When watching these types of movies, the main thing that sticks out to me is obviously the fight choreography. This movie has plenty of epic fight scenes. It started off with old recordings of fight from the main trio's younger days, and you really get to see how time has changed them when they get back into the swing of things as middle-aged men. The choreography was crisp and clean. You could tell that each character had a distinct way of fighting, some with minimal but effective movements, and others with large, flashier attacks. There was a tiny bit of plot armor, but not as much as I expected. These guys are old and out of fighting shape, except for one, which I'll get into later. So it makes sense that they wouldn't be great fighters as of current, especially while going up against people who are currently in training. The second positive I have to give this movie is the comedy. As an action comedy, I was hoping it would carry its weight in the comedic department, and I was pleasantly surprised. I typically don't expect much of these comedies these days, but The Paper Tigers delivered. Mixed in with both the action sequences and dramatic sequences, the comedy was pretty decently timed and came in often enough to make this movie a comedy, but not so much that it overshadowed the drama and action. The delivery of the lines was pretty cheesy at times, but that seemed intentional, at least to me. The last big plus I'm going to give The Paper Tigers is the big lesson that it tells. I'm not going to spoil the character arcs, but the main character struggles a lot with juggling responsibility in his life, as well as how to manage the issues he's facing. In the end, he comes to a decision and realization that I believe to be a pretty moral and just way to view conflict resolution. It hits hard and leads up to a pretty hype final battle sequence. If I had to give some small little pet peeves, it would first have to be about the way some of the characters interact and speak. I know it's supposed to be a comedy, but the characters feel a little too cartoonish at times. Another one that isn't really a big flaw in a fictional universe, but still grinds the gears of the martial artist in me, is that one of the characters is an MMA coach, and obviously in very good physical condition, unlike the other two. This means he's been training for the past couple of decades since the time skip, but it's also played as if he's not on par with the other kung fu practitioners who have been practicing, which doesn't make any logical sense. Realistically, he should be the most overpowered character in the movie. But that's just a little nitpick I have as a martial art connoisseur. I really liked this movie. It had really good action, comedy, and themes. Decent acting, and only a few nitpicks. I highly suggest you watch this movie if you're a fan of action, comedy, and martial arts. Wait, sorry, this is just a little note here. Cut out where it starts at, I really like this movie, I messed up something, I'm gonna have to redo it. I really liked this movie. It had really good action, comedy, and themes. Decent acting, and only a few nitpicks. I highly suggest you watch this movie if you're a fan of action, comedy, martial arts, or any combination of the three. Even if not, it's a pretty good movie in general. I'm going to give The Paper Tigers an 8 out of 10. Definitely check it out, as it is now on Netflix. This is Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. I'm Melissa Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. And now before we go, here's my little letter from the editor. Hello, listeners. I'm sure you're all aware of the arrival of school by now. Coming up this Tuesday, Manor kids will be returning to classes. I think these times bring both excitement and anxiety. For many students, they'll get to see their friends again and have a semblance of structure and order. But quizzes, tests, and homework, oh my. And for many parents, they'll have their children off at school, doing work and extracurriculars. So it means more freedom and less worry about what their kids are doing, in some ways. Even if the parents are still working. But it also means that parents will have the added work of paying attention to school emails, events, and how their kids are performing. But one thing that's most definitely on everyone's mind is COVID. Most of us are praying things get better, and the schooling plan can stay how it is. But there's still possibility of things getting bad enough that a hybrid or even full remote situation will have to be implemented. This school year should be interesting, if anything, so stay vigilant, folks. Hello, listeners. I'm sure you're all aware of the arrival of school by now. Coming up this Tuesday, Manor kids will be returning to classes. I think these times bring both excitement and anxiety. For many students, they'll get to see their friends again and have a semblance of structure and order. But quizzes, tests, and homework, oh my. And for many parents, they'll have their children off at school, doing work and extracurriculars. So it means more freedom and less worry about what their kids are doing, in some ways. Even if the parents are still working. But it also means that parents will have the added work of paying attention to school emails, events, and how their kids are performing. But one thing that's most definitely on everyone's mind is COVID. Most of us are praying things get better, and the schooling plan can stay how it is. But there's still possibility of things getting bad enough that a hybrid or even full remote situation will have to be implemented. The school year should be interesting, if anything, so stay vigilant, folks. That's all for Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. Special thanks to David Dan, Art Steinhauer, Diana Fredenberg, Amy Hines, Taylor Jaffe, and everyone involved with Manor Inc. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. Radio Chatskill Teen Edition is produced in partnership with WJFF Radio Catskill. I'm Elsie Halper. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
I'm Aaron Bendish. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Having your car towed is never a good feeling unless it means more public radio. Donate your unwanted car and help support this public radio station. Watch your car get towed away and feel good about it.
Just go to WJFFradio.org and click Donate. Support public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. That's WJFFradio.org. Thanks.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. We are Radio Catskill.
It's that time of year, crops of all kinds are gathered in. So next time on the Waggaload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear songs about the harvest, plus new music, poems set to music, and more. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
WJFF, Jeffersonville.